Call the Health and Policy Finance Committee to order. The agenda for today is a look at some of our health programs from a little different perspective. We've looked at them from sort of who the consumers are and how we deliver and how we fund and so forth. I think those of us in public service know that there's another aspect that occasionally we hear from our constituents, and that's the integrity that we have in those programs and how we administer eligibility, how we administer benefits, and on some occasions, of course, we hear individual cases where that may have been violated, and that tends to hit headlines, and I think we all want to have integrity. I think our structure this afternoon is sort of twofold. One is sort of look at in the aggregate the programs that we have for integrity in the health programs, what we do, how we administer, how we're organized. And then the other is to do a bit of a specific inventory of the 2003 and 2005 measures that were passed by this committee, as a matter of fact, and trying to enhance our ability to maintain program integrity. Well, that's kind of the agenda. I think let's begin right off the bat with Vicki Kunert, the Director of Performance Measurement and Quality Improvement in the Department of Human Services. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And for the record, if you'd reintroduce yourself.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Vicki Kunert. And as the agenda says, I'm Director of Performance Measurement Quality Improvement, and that is a division in Healthcare Administration at the Department of Human Services. And the reason why I'm here, within that division, I'm responsible for the SERS section, which is responsible for provider fraud and abuse. And so that's what I'll cover, provider fraud and abuse first. And others next in line will cover eligibility issues related to fraud and abuse. So I thought I would give you a review of what we do, what we cover, issues for our programs, some innovations we've done in our program integrity work, challenges ahead, and maybe touch briefly on some of the new federal act provisions that could affect our work and our finances. Program integrity at the Department of Human Services has a variety of divisions that touch our work as we pursue fraud and abuse for healthcare providers. If they work in cooperation as they do, together we can ensure proper payments, establish and enforce standards applicable to eligibility healthcare services policy, ensure that laws and rules are followed. And some of the areas that we work with are the Attorney General unit. We utilize that agency for pursuing and prosecuting fraud in medical assistance. SERS has independent authority to prosecute fraud, but we do not have the resources to take on major cases. So where we've identified a case that we think could meet the test for fraud, we pursue it to the Attorney General's for consideration, review, investigation on their own, and possible prosecution either at a civil or at a criminal level. We deal with benefit recovery that deals with collections for a third party to make sure others appropriately pay for things before the public payment occurs. We deal with claims processing a great deal. Minnesota's claims processing system has over 900 edits in its fee-for-service claims. It pays about 26 million claims a year, but these edits, which is probably one of the largest in the country, stops about 20% of those claims. Some claims are subsequently corrected and sent in, but it stops duplicate payments. It stops payments for clients that aren't eligible. It stops payments to providers that whose eligibility to be paid is either suspended or terminated. We deal with prior authorization contracts to nurses and physicians in the community that help us with determining medical necessity or prior authorizations. We, of course, deal with eligibility of the county and state staff. We deal with provider enrollment that ensures that the providers are legitimate to be paid by our system. Of course, we deal with benefit and policy program staff who determine legitimate services and providers. And we deal with provider training. And then we have SERS, which is the section I'm responsible for. While the claims processing ops and checks payments before we make them. CSRS responsibility is to look at claims after we've paid them and look for billing errors, fraud, and abuse. Now, one of the single-page handouts I passed out kind of gives a definition. The large majority of CSRS work in looking at provider problems in healthcare payments are errors and abuse. Patterns of improper billing or single errors of that are just mistakes. People that are could be effective healthcare providers are not necessarily capable business people. And we find a lot of sloppy paperwork, lack of documentation, things like that. We handle, review, or investigate about 400 to 600 cases a year, but we send over a few dozen to the Attorney General that deal with that we think could be fraud. So as you can see, the large majority are abusive patterns and practices. We still recover payments where that's appropriate, but fraud is usually the term used most frequently, but it's the least frequent of our attention. Besides looking for errors, looking for abuse, abusive patterns, or looking for fraud, we are constantly reviewing claims that have been paid for compliance with law and rule, for how they match or don't match on policy decisions of the agency, whether there's additional edits that we should add to the 900 we already are working with, and with areas for provider education. The extent that we can prevent it will save us far more money than chasing bad guys after the fact. Our primary goal in CSRS is to prevent improper payments from being made and to correct the situation so it doesn't happen again. Another important component of our work in CSRS is the recipient restriction program. This is not recipient eligibility, whether they are legitimate to receive healthcare services. This is where the clients themselves are misusing services. The large majority of these clients are individuals that are using services that is clearly drug-seeking behavior, like multiple different emergency rooms in a single weekend. One of our recent cases we had used over about 17 or 18 different emergency rooms over a very few week period for seeking narcotics and other pain medications. What the program does is restrict, as if you will, the client to being served and managed with a single primary physician. We do not restrict access to services. They can see the specialists they need, get the services they need, get the medication they need, but it's limited to a single physician managing it or working with the other specialists that they know of and a single pharmacy to sort of nip this in the bud. We currently have about 700 recipients, and our estimates is that over the last four-year period, we've probably saved about $3 million from largely drug claims that we didn't pay. We recently, one of our new innovations that we're very pleased with, we have just this past month or so finished working out a universal restriction program with the health plans we have under contract. What we had seen was a pattern of individuals with drug-seeking behavior bouncing from a health plan to a health plan to fee-for-service, and each time, each successive health plan had to look for the pattern for a few months and say, hey, there's something wrong here. And now with a universal restriction, one entity that starts the restriction program, we all, if the person moves for whatever reason, we continue that restriction for the two-year period and watch their claims carefully. We kind of do it all together. The end result for the client is that their care is coordinated, that they get appropriate care, they get appropriate services, and there aren't misuse of the program. In 2005, I kind of mentioned this before, CSRS handled, reviewed, or investigated over 600 cases, and we secured over $4 million to be recovered. And some of those include settlements agreements from the Attorney General's office. Most of the payments that CSRS deals with are on credit balance or recoveries so that we take a portion out of each subsequent provider's claims to the agency. We don't mean to shut these providers down where we found abuse. If they are viable providers, we take a modest amount out of each successive payments so they can continue to operate, and we get our claim, we get our recoveries over a year or two or longer, depending on the situation. Another effective feature of our program is that all fee-for-service recipients receive a monthly statement of what we paid for on their behalf. And that turns out to be an excellent source. We have a hotline, a fraud hotline that is used by providers and employers and employees, but also recipients. And when those notices go out, we get dozens of calls. And frankly, last year we handled, I think, 2,600 recipient calls that said, I didn't receive this service. Or my mother died a week ago and this nursing home is still billing you for 2 months more, or whatever it is. I just made that example up. But they say, you know, we didn't receive the service you paid for, and we check it out. And sometimes about a third of CSRS investigative cases come from these innocent calls from clients that say, I don't think that's really what I received. I don't think I went there or saw that dentist or whatever the situation was. So it's an excellent resource for us. Another area of innovation that isn't quite up and running yet but is in the works is, starting last summer, we have decided to enroll PCAs, the individual caregiver PCAs. And that is going to be an important tool for CSRS to deal with. We have numerous cases where individual PCA caregivers, unknowing to the employer they work with, become employed by three or four more employers and submit claims for dozens and dozens of hours, often more than 24 hours in a day. They're very impressive. And clearly they're claiming for hours that never occurred. And so they could have three or four providers that each authorize 30 or 40 hours, and if they have four or five of these, they can make a lot of money. But the fact is, very vulnerable clients aren't getting the service. And so the PC enrollment, part of the requirement, will be that on the claim form they identify which PCA provided the service to Aunt Mabel or Susan Johnson or whomever, and then we can track and see where all these PCAs are providing service and does the claiming make sense. So far we've registered or enrolled close to 13,000 PCAs, and in just doing that, part of it involved checking the background studies. So far, with 13,000, we found 102 PCAs that were operating as PCAs with a failed background check. So these people should not have been employed, should not have been providing care. And so far, we've stopped 102 of them. And for that alone, we are very pleased with this enrollment process. Once the enrollment is finished, we will be analyzing the data and start tracking the activities of individual PCAs. The new federal act that has just been passed, we have a lot of questions. There isn't a lot of clear definition. In Chapter 3 of it, it covers, it's called Eliminating Fraud, Waste, and Risk Contracts. Clearly, CMS is going to take a stronger role in provider oversight. There are Medicaid integrity contract requirements. CMS will have a comprehensive program integrity plan. There's money going to CMS. There's money going to the OIG. It's not clear how that might be distributed to us. CMS is getting 100 new staff to be deployed. I would bet they're not going to be deployed evenly across the country. They may be deployed in certain hot spots. There is some potential state legislation that may be brought before you this session. The False Claims Act. If state statute is consistent with the Federal Claims False Claims Act, we are potentially able to realize a 10 percentage point reduction in the federal share of recoveries. Right now, when we identify $100,000 to recover, 60 days after we've identified it, even before we can recover it ourselves, we send the federal government $50,000. 10 percentage points would be a great savings, and we figure just from CSRS alone, the section I'm responsible for, we could save maybe as much as a couple hundred thousand to the general fund each year. So we are looking into our own legislation, looking at the details, and that may be a potential piece of state legislation this session. The other handout you received, I'm sorry, I went past it quickly, describes the universal recipient restriction program that we've worked out with the health plans, but it also describes the purpose and how the restriction program works. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
So let me try one that's always sort of interest, because I... on occasion talking to people in this kind of integrity business say that there's a really good return on investment. And one is then tempted to say, well, gee whiz, if we invested something more, would we get that leverage? I mean, I'm wondering where you feel we're at this point with what we're staffed and able to do as compared, for example, to the possibility that we could get, if we made additional investment, we would get additional return. Are we... is there room yet for more? Are we at the right kind of complement at this point that pretty well maximizes our return?
Mr. Chairman, we see a lot of offers of software from vendors who do describe great returns. A good portion of the returns they are describing are for like duplicate payments and things that the edit system prevents. So I don't think we would realize those great returns. But that said, last session you gave us three investigative positions, and we hadn't raised our investigator, expanded our investigative staff for over 10 years, and we are very grateful to those for those new investigative positions. We're going to expand our investigations in the area of hospitals, and particularly home care and PCA areas. So. I don't think we have the optimum number of staff yet. Part of the good things that you gave us last session was additional funds to expand our analytic tools, and we're pursuing that as well. And that's the part that we're going to pursue. It was partly advised by the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report. We are going to systematically go through most of our major provider types and determine the actual abuse rate. Because right now we survey looking at all kinds of patterns of providers, but we haven't actually measured what is the abuse rate provider type by provider type. So over the next year or two, we can give a better idea of what is the scale of the problem based on provider types.
And then one other question, I think we have some other people with a question too, but just one other. You described a process whereby there's kind of a withholding to sort of recoup. I'm not sure if it's just fraud abuse, but at what level does it turn into a kind of a criminal prosecution, and how often does that happen?
Mr. Chairman, the scale of cases that we touch is like 600 versus a few dozen, but the Attorney General identifies more on their own as well. So I would have to get back to you and the committee on the numbers of those that turns into actual, completed prosecutions.
Yeah, if you could do that, appreciate it.
I can do that.
Representative Demo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Cunard. Following up on Chairman Bradley's question, when you respond to that, I'd like to see a breakdown of actually how many have been prosecuted either criminally or a civil, because you said it can be one or the other. And then I got a number somewhere, I think it might be off the website, that says that for every $1 you invest, you're recovering or generating almost $5. Have you seen that? That $1 invested returns, I think it's $4.91?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I haven't seen that, but I think that's low.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, ma'am, then what I'd like to see in addition, because I assume you can't do it today, I don't think you were prepared to respond to this, I'd love to see the breakdown of where that's coming from, because if I heard you correctly, at the beginning of your remarks, you said that fraud is really a minimal issue. It's more of a errors and duplicative billings and that sort of thing. But I'd like to get an understanding for how big a problem fraud is and how we're identifying it. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, yes. Until we really look at provider type or fighter type, it's hard to say that that's all that's out there, that it's minimum. I mean, I can give you what we have, but we can't say necessarily. We get a lot of statements at the national level that you know, there's 10% fraud, 2% fraud, 1% fraud. You know, it's very hard to quantify that, but I can certainly tell you what Minnesota's experience has been from our work and the Attorney General's work.
Wonderful. Mr. Chairman, one last one.
Representative,
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ma'am, then just so you understand where I'm going, since I've been here, everybody talks in terms of anecdotal information or, you know, these are the numbers. And specifically, what I want to know is where do these numbers come from? If you think a dollar invested for the return of almost $5 is low, I'd like to know what the actual return is, and then what gets factored into that that conclusion, because I want to know if it's real. And forgive me, I haven't become cynical yet. I'm just skeptical. I'm still at the first level. So anything you can give me that I can look at and actually understand what the situation is, I'd love. And anything else anybody can think of would be helpful.
And Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to provide you is, with that picture, is recoveries from the department for their program integrity work, not just my section.
That would be great.
Well, okay. I think we'd welcome that.
Yeah.
And I think part of what is sort of underlying here, I mean, as much as understanding, if I can use this as an example, I have a relative who, for a part of her career, made a living by simply reviewing hospital billings and payments, and more than returned the investment by doing that. And I think that's it. I mean, I think we've used the word fraud sort of interchangeably here, kind of to what may be just honest errors. I mean, I just had an example recently given to me of somebody who had a bottle of pills that was $1,000, kind of brought attention. It was obviously an error. I mean, you know, and that happens once in a while. So even discovery of those has. And so the question sort of gets begged is just where does the curve break? And if, you know, if the legislature said, you know what, we'll put together another 100,000, million, whatever, if we get a 5-for-1, we don't get very many of those. And I wouldn't mind this investment, but I think we're all wise enough to know that it has diminishing returns at some point. And that's kind of why I was asking the question about where we think we are. Representative Goodman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Is this Knuth?
Cooner.
First of all, I think you did a very good presentation. I'm glad to hear that there's so much work going on in the department. I have a question. Does your unit, besides financial fraud and abuse, do you deal with county abuse? Is it mostly private providers, or is it if there's complaints about a county social services unit and their relationship with the clients, would you be doing anything with that, or with the way that they're handling state money or federal money, would you be working on that? Do you have any authority to do that?
Ms. Goodwin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, it would cover counties to the extent that we are providing a medical payment to a county who are healthcare providers. It wouldn't be the social service aspect. And also, if it's something of an area of professional abuse, questionable physician practice or whatever, we also make our referrals to the appropriate licensing board. But for counties, they are healthcare providers, and so if it's a misuse of payment in that area, that would be under our responsibility as well.
Thank you. And is there a unit within DHS that does investigate complaints about county social services, or does your agency not have the authority to do that?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Goodwin, I don't know, but I will find out
Okay.
and get back to you.
one more question.
Sure, that's a good one.
And I'm interested in the way you handle it when you find out that there, or you believe there's fraud or abuse or misbillings or whatever going on. Does the provider, first of all, get the opportunity to pay for that? At what point do you decide it could be fraud or that there's an amount of abuse going on that is beyond just, inaccurate billing or whatever? How does that process work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, each case is very unique to the circumstances. When it comes to our attention by a variety of ways, we either get a call through our review of the claims analysis or whatever. We often visit the provider, ask for documentation, go back certain time period, come back, do further analysis, do a lot of conversation. If we come to a finding that there's an abusive practice or misbilling or overpayments made, we send the provider a notice. We also, when we go out to the provider, we also give them notice. We don't, show up this afternoon without notice. We give them a notice that we are taking action and offer an informal meeting with them to work out, show them our evidence, clarify the laws and rules that apply in this circumstance, and work out a payment program. If there is evidence that we consider to be fraudulent, we do not make that determination, although we have the authority to do that. We quickly refer to the Attorney General for them to make a determination. We don't make the determination ourselves because we aren't going to proceed with prosecution. So does that kind of get to the answer what you're seeking?
Mr. Chair, yeah, it comes close, but I'm just wondering if there's a more specific way of, is there a point at which there's so many, do you continue to watch each provider to see if you're getting misbillings or at a certain level, at a certain number that you then say, okay, this is too often to be a mistake based on the ratio of patients that particular provider sees, or, do you have kind of a set of criteria you use to make those decisions?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Kerner?
Representative, yes. Sometimes there's not enough evidence, there's not a clear pattern, so we watch the providers over time. Like an odd transportation billing on Sundays and holidays. Then we start watching and look for the extended pattern to see if it persists. And even afterwards, if we resolve things smoothly, we might follow up at a time period later with that provider or look at other providers to see how the pattern is. We don't have set criteria because it's a very dynamic arena. So depending on the provider type, we look for patterns we expect to see, we look for patterns we don't expect to see. And so we are constantly watching before, during, and after cases to look exactly for what you're describing.
You. Probably wouldn't be a good idea to publish specific criteria under which to just barely keep yourself the radar. So, Mr. Goodwin, would you like to take care of the questions? Okay, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Kuhner, a couple of completely different questions. You talked about people going to emergency room to get prescriptions for certain drugs that they probably shouldn't have. But and then you said you refused payment on some of those?
Ms. Kuhner?
Yes.
Who doesn't get paid? Is it the individual that was getting the prescriptions or the pharmacist that actually?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, particularly pharmacies, because that's the most common case. As you know, they get paid at a point of sale, and at that point of sale, they know whether this particular client is, first of all, eligible for the program, and also through that system, through our eligibility verification system, they know instantaneously that that client is restricted and their pharmacy should not be issuing medications to that person. So they know. And so who we would be blocking the payment to is anything other than the designated pharmacy. But they know at the point that this is happening. So the savings are, you know, in a fitness sense, deflected payments not made. So, and sometimes, you know, an ER situation could well be a legitimate ER situation, and then we ask for medical records back and forth, and we say, okay, that was a legitimate ER use, but the other 15, maybe not in that two-week period.
Ms. Green, is that implies that all pharmacists then are hooked up sort of electronically for that real-time assessment of this particular, so there's not a duplicate or a piling on of it? Is that the assumption that all pharmacists have access?
Mr. Chairman, that is my understanding for pharmacies. Not all providers are hooked up, but they all have access to the electronic verification system, which will tell them the eligibility and whether the client in question is restricted and whether they are the designated provider.
I think I heard, you know, the 900 edits, that's systems, so that that's pretty sophisticated. And then I heard when you send out this, on the fee-for-service of the actual copies of billings, that you depend on some feedback if people spot something that doesn't make any sense. Are there any random audits done that just sort of once in a while look at either an individual provider or an area or something that would be another possible avenue?
Mr. Chair, that is our intent with systematically provider type by provider type. We're going to do random sampling of specific provider types and just check for compliance with documentation, the requirements specific to that provider type. And that is our intent with the expanded staff.
And although this may be coming up later, but since you brought it up, about the additional three people that were authorized, is there a timeline? I think some of us expected that those people would have been on board by now. Is there a specific timeline for that to happen? Ms. Cohen?
Mr. Chairman, so did we. It's being posted, and we're starting some interviews. We hope to get them on board as soon as possible. It's a challenge in this area with dealing with personnel rules and things like that, and this is a kind of a tough area to hire staff in. So we hoped it would have been sooner than this, but it should be in the next month or so.
Well, I hope so too. What's that, woman?
I have one more.
No, I'm sorry. That's not what, I'm sorry. You didn't give me a
sure. Well, sure, you did a good follow-up. Same kind of questions I had on that area. The completely different area. PCA fraud and abuse, how does that vary between people who are doing home health care versus PCAs that work in group homes, caddy-type facilities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, you mean the distinction in abuse?
Yeah, more abuse with home health care PCAs versus those that work in group homes.
I would have to check and see if we have that information to distinguish by employer type. I would have to check and see if there's a distinction. And I'll get back to you.
Mr. Chair, the PCAs that are working in group homes may be, you know, giving care to a whole host of clients. You know, intermittently working with this one, just like nurses' aides do. And I'd be interested to see how you keep track of, and how it, if it's cost effective to even keep track of how much time they're spending with each particular patient.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, yes, we certainly do pay for shared care arrangements like you suggest, like you're describing. But our regulations require that we identify actual services to actual clients, and that can be a challenge administratively for the providers in question.
And to their members, you know, today's testimony, we'd ask that it be restricted just to the department so we could sort of have an update. I did get a request from, I believe, the Home Health Care Association. So in your packet, you have a couple of page summary of some of the concerns that they have about this very area. So you might want to take a look at that as well. Dr. Renner, you look like you have a question.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Kuhnert came up, I was thinking about what you had said, that we're going to expand into looking at hospitals and nursing homes. And
more, yes.
More, okay.
More.
Which providers, do you have a certain specific group of providers that you currently concentrate on?
Ms. Kuhnert?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, we usually don't speak about that. We are responsible for surveillance of all providers that we pay for. So this, the additional staff will be to expand in the home care and the hospital areas, but we conduct surveillance and analysis of all providers.
Fair enough. Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Very helpful. Next we have Ramona Scott, please, the Director of Program Assessment and Integrity, Department of Human Services.
Mr. Chair and members,
welcome to
Scott Pace with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Happy Valentine's Day to all of you.
Oh, wow. That's nice. We have the cookies and candies. And
our state budgets are tight. Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity to update the committee on our program integrity initiatives in Minnesota. And I'd like to talk with you about our current program integrity initiatives and then also give you an update on the progress that we've made since the 2005 session. In terms of background, we have many ways of assuring program integrity in our public welfare programs, and these initiatives might include the quality control reviews or quality audits. We have ways of looking at county management, evaluation reviews, corrective action, and matching of data. And then our fraud prevention and control programs, which include, for example, a fraud hotline that we have in operation as a service to the public. Last year, in 2004, we took 1,100 calls from the public, and about 40% of those have been referred to the counties for investigation. I have our hotline numbers available on a handout that was passed out to all of you. Now, the information that I'd like to share with you today focuses on preventing and reducing welfare at the recipient level. So what I'm talking about are people who receive cash, food support, child care, or medical benefits that they're not eligible for. And if you look at the categories where we see the most types of fraud, it's people who are not reporting income. So unreported income, household composition, and assets are the three major kinds. The fraud prevention programs we have in the state, we have a program called Fraud Prevention and Investigation. And it's a front-end program. It's a process of identifying fraud early on when a recipient comes in or when an applicant comes in, rather, or where a recipient is receiving it. And their worker looks at the case and says, something here just doesn't make sense. Something's not right. And so we have investigators who work out would interview these people and then determine whether or not they are eligible for assistance. The second mode we have is a route that would go through the court system, the more traditional criminal investigation. And then to make that circle, we also have a collections program where people who have received benefits that they weren't entitled to are required to pay it back. I spoke a little bit about the fraud investigation prevention program that we have. It's a very, very good program. And we have about 56 counties who participate in that program. And again, that's upfront prevention of fraud. And in 2004, for fraud prevention investigation, there were approximately 8,000 investigations that the county fraud investigators did, and we found that in almost half of them there was some issue there, and that caused us to either stop the benefits or reduce the benefits. We identified about $13.5 million in cost avoidance, and what I mean by that is those were benefits that we stopped from going out, about $13.5 million, and we saved or collected in cost avoidance, we saved or we collected back about $4.91 for every dollar you spent. And earlier we had a question regarding that, and that has to do with the payback in terms of fraud prevention investigation. So it's the payback we get for doing the recipient fraud prevention investigation. We also are able, given the laws in Minnesota, to disqualify people if they're not, if we find them guilty of fraud, we can disqualify them for a year on the first offense, 2 years on the second offense, and forever on the third. Mr. Chair, the second route we have is the more traditional route where people are having are being investigated through the court system, criminal investigations. Our investigators in the county completed approximately 2,000 criminal investigations, and we found in 59% of them, or about 1,180 of them, that there were benefits that had been illegally obtained. In the criminal investigations we do, we disqualify the recipients. Some are actually go to jail, and they are required to pay the benefits back. I spoke about the third part of the circle, and that's the collections and recovery. We have a program in place called the Treasury Offset Program, and that intercepts federal tax returns for food stamp benefits that people received that they weren't eligible for. That too has been a program that's grown. We collect about $1.6 million a year in that program, and in the past 10 years we've collected $17.7 million in getting back monies for food stamps that people received that they weren't eligible for. And then just a quick progress report about how we're doing since the last session. In the last session you gave us additional resources to better manage our health care programs, and you gave us the resources to do direct investigation of fraud for the Minnesota Care the Minnesota Care program. And with this initiative, we'll directly investigate Minnesota Care fraud. We have one person on board right now. We're planning on hiring another three by spring. We've had a humble start. In 2005, we did about 39 pieces of work cases, and the recoveries for that were about $61,000, and the cost avoidance, so benefits or the capitation payment that we didn't pay out, about $62,000. Right now, we have about 128 referrals for Minnesota Care that are pending investigation. So we're in the process of ramping up that the initiative. In terms of the types of findings, things we find with Minnesota Care, we find that sometimes people underreport their income, that they're falsely reporting their household composition. So they're saying that there are children in the house, or maybe more children in the house than there actually are. And then another program that the legislature gave us money for was one that's required by CMS, and that had to do with a program called PERM, Payment Error Rate Measurement, Recipient Eligibility. It's a federal requirement, and we were given some positions for that. Now, for recipient eligibility, PERM, Payment Error Rate Measurement, is on hold. We were given 7 positions. It's on hold because the federal government hasn't decided how they want that information to be collected. So for the recipients, that is on hold. And then another piece was the eligibility quality control for the Medicaid programs. And under federal law, we're required to perform audits on eligibility for the Medicaid program. And we are in the process of doing that. That is up and running. Mr. Chair, thanks for the opportunity to brief you, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Yes, remember, Mr. Chairman, ma'am, how much money did we actually give you for these additional? Is it like $4 to $5 million, somewhere in there?
Mr. Chair and Representative, are you speaking about the total positions that the department received?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I don't have the information on the total number of positions. Perhaps we can get that information to you.
Mr. Chairman,
why don't we narrow it then to just the issue that you were just giving us testimony on.
Sure. Mr. Chair, for the investigative positions for recipient eligibility, we were given, I can give you the number, approximate number of FTEs, full-time equivalents. It's approximately 4 to 5 FTEs that we were given funding for. For the federal requirements, we were given approximately 12 FTEs, and of the 13 FTEs of the 12, the 13 we're not using 7 because we're waiting recommendations from the feds on what to do with PERM.
Mr. Chairman, could you explain to me the number, ma'am, the last statement?
Sure. Mr. Chair, we were given funds from the legislature last year for a program called PERM. It's payment. It's called payment error rate measurement, and this is a quality audit that we have to do for the federal government. The federal government told us they were going forward with having to do this payment error rate measurement. But after the session ended, we heard back from them, and they said that they hadn't figured out what they wanted to do around the recipient piece of this, of payment error rate measurement. So they didn't have the qualifiers for how they wanted states to audit this particular area. And so we are waiting to hear from the federal government on how they want us to construct the audit.
Mr. Chairman. And I'm sorry, I keep saying ma'am. Hey, how do you pronounce your last name?
My last name is pronounced Scarpace.
Scarpace. Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Scarpace, question that I have, I thought you testified that just in the 39 cases in 2005 that your department looked at, you had, in please clarify this for me. I thought you said you had roughly 61,000 that was paid fraudulently or mistakenly, and that you saved another 60-some thousand dollars by blocking payments or not making payments. Did I mishear that?
Ms. Garpins?
Mr. Chair and Representative. What I talked about was the Fraud Prevention Investigation Program, and what we believe that we've saved through cost avoidance, which is benefits that we haven't paid out. In other words, we stop people from getting the benefits because they weren't eligible. Cost avoidance and what we were able to recover, so monies that we got back, that is about $13.5 million. And we have a formula that we use to determine the amount of cost avoidance. It's based on 3 months' worth of benefits that they would have received.
So, Mr. Chairman, is the number? Ms. Scarpace, $13 million is the calculated savings on 39 cases?
Oh, no, Mr. Chair, for fraud prevention and investigation, we did 8,000 cases. Of the 8,000 cases, about half of them had benefits that were stopped or reduced. Fraud prevention investigation for fraud control, which is the criminal aspect of it, 2,000 investigations and 1,180 of them were ineligible for benefits. Perhaps the number that you're referring to is what I was talking about for Minnesota Care investigations. For 2005, we did 39 cases for Minnesota Care. The recoveries that we have, which are the overpayments that were established, so the amount of dollars overpaid, $61,810. Cost avoidance for not having to pay the capitation rate, about $62,000.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Newman,
so then do I add those two numbers, for the total savings, or is that not the right way to do it?
Ms. Crawford?
Yes, Mr. Chair, you can add the two together. I think in terms of booking the savings into the budget, I don't think we figure cost avoidance as part of our budget process. But yes, the savings overall, you could add the two together.
Which, Mr. Chair, if that's the case, the 2003 legislative audit said that at least a third of the applicants were misreporting income or earned income. Can we extrapolate from that the savings could be much greater if we actually get this thing moving and have people on board to do this type of investigation?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yes, when we get our additional three investigators on board, I think we will see these numbers increase greatly. We're working on some methods to identify the cases that, you know, where the abuse is potentially at its worst. And so, yes, we will see an increase in the payback here.
Okay.
Ms. Parkes, I don't know if we're talking about the same three that we talked about in our prior discussion. You may have heard that discussion. Are we talking about the same three people?
No, Mr. Chair. We're talking about different sets of positions.
Okay.
So three investigators on the provider side, three on the eligibility side.
Ms. Carpes, then, sort of pose the same question, or maybe somewhat of an assertion, because I think a lot of us thought that this was going to be happening in the latter part of 2005, and here we are into 2006. What's the reason why it's taking this time? And obviously, we got one on board, and you said hopefully we'll be up to three by spring.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like these are terrific opportunities for a good return on investment, and I think a lot of us are anxious to see that return, because I think some of that was booked actually into our budget that we, the fiscal notes that we used to make these decisions.
Mr. Chair, we apologize for the length of time that it's taken to get those positions up and running. We do have our position descriptions done. The jobs are going to be posted, and we will have things up and running by the spring.
Ms. Carpus, can you be a little bit more specific? Spring is a three-month time frame. Can you give me a target?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would say we would have these positions hired for by the end of March or the beginning of April.
Well, Ms. Carpus, it goes without saying, I think the sooner the better. I'd like to get good people, of course, but I think we're all anxious to see it continue. Ms. Carpus, I think you mentioned something about 56 counties. I'm curious, why not all counties? Has this got something to do with the size of counties or something, or what is it about the remaining counties?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have two initiatives. One is the fraud prevention investigation. That is an optional program that counties can come into. We contract with the counties to perform that program, and they are paid for those contracts. 56 counties have opted in to that. It's optional. All the counties, though, are involved in fraud control, so the criminal side. We have money that's been given to us from the legislature. We really are at a point where we don't have the funds to further expand fraud prevention investigation in the state of Minnesota.
And, well, let me try it. I posed the question before, so this is now more on the consumer side, about where we think we are in terms of return on investment. In other words, the question sort of is, if we found additional dollars to invest in this area, would we continue to get the $4.91 or some kind of extra return on investment? Is there room for us to add resources and get a good return?
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Carpus?
I believe that there is, Mr. Chair. I think that the fraud prevention investigation program, which we find extremely, extremely successful, I think that there may be opportunity there to grow that program to some of the other counties in the state. And also, we haven't had any cost of living increase in that program for the counties, the current 56 counties who are participating in that program. So those might be avenues where we could get some future return on it, yes.
And then, Ms. Garpins, another sort of detail question. You talked about the numbers of people who lose their eligibility benefits. Is that a permanent status? Is there something then that sort of goes on record that they would be prevented from 6 months coming back and reapplying?
Yes, Ms. Garpins. If someone is disqualified from the program, that is entered into our automated systems, a Maxis system, and that person would be prevented if they tried to apply. They would be told that they weren't eligible because they had been disqualified. A person's disqualified for 1 year on the first offense, 2 years on the second, and then forever thereafter. And we do keep electronic records of that, yes.
Thank you. And then one more that occurs to me. On occasion I hear from constituents talking about somebody who they allegedly say came from another state and is boasting about having benefits in other states at the same time. Where are we at in terms of being able to do systems verification on people, I'm assuming within our own state across counties, if it were not counties, that they would want, if you could verify that part, that we'd have the ability to verify and catch that. But what about across state lines?
Yes, Ms. Chair, we do have a number of databases that we use where we can exchange data regarding income, regarding unearned income and new hire matches and so forth. Mr. Chair, I don't know about reciprocating with other states, but I can get that information to you.
I'd appreciate that. I think there's sufficient enough incidents. I know they're somewhat anecdotal, but there's sufficient numbers, at least I hear, that would be helpful to be able to respond to my constituents. And first question, members. What's that one? Oh, I'm sorry. That's not a good one. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Garpace, I'm looking at and thinking about what you've got here for the number of investigations. It looks like about 8,000 investigations. Is that right? But I'm also hearing about AMFIP, which is a program that this committee doesn't deal with as much. So I'm more interested in the health care fraud and what would an abuse and what would that look like? From the client problem, how would somebody be accused of abuse of health care benefits as a client?
Ms. Garpins?
Mr. Chair and Representative Goodwin, quite often the way we find out about fraud and abuse in the medical programs is through Minnesota Family Investment Program or Food Support Program, because quite often people receive multiple programs. And so quite often we will find that someone who is receiving MFIP and food support and they aren't eligible for the program, that is a way that we find that they're also not eligible for our health care programs. Some of the counties do some direct investigation of the health care programs, but quite often it's a paired investigation where we're looking at MFIP, we're looking at food support, and we're looking at medical, and one leads to the next in terms of finding that someone is ineligible.
Okay, one more follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of these 8,000 cases, maybe you already said this and I missed it, how many of them would be healthcare investigations?
Mr. Chair and Representatives, I don't have the breakdown of that information. I could get that for you, but our numbers that I gave today are a combination of people who might be on all three programs, people who might be on one program, or people who might be on two programs. But we could provide that information to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Person Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just following up on that last line of questions, the Minnesota care population doesn't really overlap with MFIP very much, so it would be good to know those details and the numbers and see how much we're really getting into the healthcare programs. So I'd be interested in that also. As far as disqualifications of individuals, how many, can you give us a rough estimate of how many have been disqualified since those provisions were enacted into law in 2003?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, let me just find my data here. For fraud prevention and investigation, our upfront program, about 400 recipients were disqualified from that. And in our traditional criminal investigations, about 490 people were disqualified from the program. So just about 1,000.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, those are numbers for 2004. So not inclusive of 2003. I can get you the...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As far as income and asset verification, how is that working right now? Are we getting data from, like, deed for the unemployment?
Ms. Grappins?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do have multiple data exchanges that we run with deed through New Hire. We do have those sorts of data exchanges in place, yes.
Is that, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Scarface, is that kind of on the front end to check qualifications, or is that investigating afterwards?
Ms. Scarface?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the data matches wouldn't run simultaneous to the person running in. In other words, the data matches aren't necessarily run at the point that the client is in the office, but they are run within a certain number of days afterwards.
Is there, how's the follow-up then? Are they initially put on for, 15, 20 days, and then they're later told they're ineligible? And in such cases, I believe the laws that we passed in 2003 allow you to go recoup the dollars from those individuals. Is that being done?
Yes, Ms. Grappin. Mr. Chair and Representative, a person would be potentially put on public assistance, but if there's anything that comes back on the data matches regarding income or assets or unknown employment, then the worker in charge of that case has to talk with the client and verify that information. So there are flags that come up in the computerized system that tell the worker that there's something that needs to be considered, more verification needs to be provided.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite getting to where I want to be here. So if they do the follow-up verification, which I understand because, there could be incorrect data reported back, if they're determined to be ineligible, that they did misreport their income, are you going in and recouping the dollars that were used from the ineligible person?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that is part of the process. So if they are ineligible for benefits, we establish a claim against that person, and then we recoup or we take the money back from them.
Thank you.
Representative Fremba?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Scarface, so if someone is fraudulent in the food area, in MFIP, and the health care, is that considered one fraudulent or three?
Ms. Scarface.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm going to need some help on that one. I don't know. Could we get back to you on that? I don't know if it's one instance or three instances.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Scarpace, I was thinking after I asked you questions earlier about this first Representative Goodwin's questions about how do we determine fraud in our, I'm interpreting your question, how do we determine fraud in our health care situation? And the issue that we tried to address last session with some legislation has to do with verification of assets and income, because that's how you determine eligibility, and that's really where the problem, at least the upfront problem that was identified by the auditor. The question I have, because somebody in the department or folks in the department have said, why don't you wait until Health Match is in place? It's up and running, because that'll make it easier. But in fact, and this is a statement, but I would like your feelings on it. Health Match isn't going to change how we evaluate what people report as their assets and income for purposes of determining eligibility, is it?
Ms. Grappins, Mr. Chair and Representative, I have a colleague here from the department who can address Health Match, if you'd like. Linda Davis Johnson is here, and she can probably answer your question.
I think the last time we talked about Health Match, we had a whole meeting that got consumed, so we may need the short version. I think there is interest, however, because we had an awful lot of things that were deferred to Health Match. So if we can respond specifically to this question, then maybe a brief update on the where we're at.
Certainly, Mr.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourself, please.
I'm Linda Davis-Johnson, the Project Director for Health Match at Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, Representative, the work required in programming our computer systems to do additional verifications would have been quite complex in our existing legacy systems, Maxis and MMIS, so the decision was made to put those efforts into programming them with Health Match. So when Health Match comes up, we will be having all of those mandatory verification requirements that we have not had up till this point. Health Match, in addition, will have system interfaces that are more sophisticated than what we've been able to do with our mainframe systems, and so we will be getting data exchanges in some cases more often and more efficiently. Also, we're able to build in some edits that we couldn't do with our previous technology. For example, with the Minnesota Care program, if a client reports zero income 2 months in a row with Minnesota Care, there will be an edit that comes up that will force that worker to then go in and do some investigation. So with the new technology and the way that we're building this eligibility rules engine that is at the heart of Health Match, we're able to do more than we could do before.
Mr. Chairman,
do you remember?
And it's Ms. Is it Johnson Davis or Davis Johnson? All right, Ms. Davis Johnson. Well, then maybe the issue that I have is one of communication, because what you're talking about is once eligibility has been determined, once the application has been submitted, the information is provided, you're going to have a very complex a database system that will share with perhaps Deed or other databases to do additional verification. But that's not what these reforms were about. These reforms talked about the application process itself, and I believe I have a one or two page application form that comes off of the website for Minnesota Care that simply requires the applicant to provide the information. And as I talking to some folks in the department, I was asking, what does Health Match have to do with whether or not the applicant provides the necessary information up front to determine eligibility? And it shouldn't. You're talking about once they're in the system, you're going to have a very complex and probably a better ability to investigate fraud. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's actually both. If the policy is such that a client is unable to receive assistance in the first place unless they've met mandatory verification requirements, then we would not open up a case for them in the first place. The case would sit in a pending status until all requirements had been met.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then, ma'am, it sounds like I have concerns as to why the reforms haven't already been instituted then, because the two shouldn't conflict. The reforms specifically were with respect to the application and whether or not the requirements to establish eligibility had been met by the applicant. And I keep getting responses that, you know, once the application's been submitted, then we have to do all this extra work. Well, that shouldn't be the case. You either satisfy the requirements, which then would have your department open a file, as you say, and would start the process running. I guess maybe we need to have some more conversations outside of the hearing about how we can, maybe there was just a misunderstanding as to how those were supposed to be implemented.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can only speak to the Health Match. That's my single focus. So I'd be happy to follow up with you, provide another presentation. Whatever you would need, we'd be happy to provide.
I just have them one
more.
Ma'am, are we, thank you, Mr. Chairman, are we ever going to see Health Match? Or are we just going to talk about it?
That's been a booming question. That's been a good one. Were you thinking about asking that question?
No, I did go. But I was thinking about it.
I'm sorry, Ms. Davis Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we are definitely going to see this system come up. I'd like a different job. I've been on this one for a few years. What we are building is very exciting. We have, as we told you last session, based on some of the changes that we needed to put into place for new policy changes in some areas, we did extend our implementation date by 5 months. As we said last year, our analysis has proven that that's the amount of time that we'll need. We are scheduled to come up with a beta test in January of 07, which means that we will be testing live data, but system will be not actually issuing benefits. Those will be going out through the legacy system. We're scheduled to pilot in March of 07, and we are working with our county partners on a phased implementation. So we will be implementing throughout 07, and the counties would like more time to implement rather than less. They don't want to do what, technically I'd love to do a big bang, flip the switch and put it out there, but that's too onerous a burden on the county workers. So we will have a system for you.
Thank you.
Mr. Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Davis-Johnson. you maybe can't answer this question for me, but I keep hearing the same issue over and over again from people from the department that the three systems we have, MAXIS, MMIS, and now the Health Match, the reason that we needed Health Match is because the other two very expensive systems, MMIS and MAXIS, don't talk to each other, and that there's territorial issues within the department of people that run the MAXIS and people that run the MMIS, and that this is part of the reason we have spent $600, I believe, last session I looked at the numbers and it came up to about $636 million so far on these three computer systems, none of which talk to each other or get the information on fraud and abuse and things that we are hoping to be able to get. So I'm just wondering, how much more money are we going to have to spend statewide on to fix the very expensive systems that we already have in place that aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing and that aren't talking to each other and so forth?
That may be a little bit unfair to Ms. Davis-Johnson, but if you can put it in your own domain, what remains to be spent in the Health Match implementation?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, the part of the history of the issues between the MAXIS and the MMIS systems is that they're based on older technology that did not work together. One of the great things about Health Match is the interoperability of this web-based technology will allow for better system interfaces. Health Match is being built as a component of the MMIS, and the MMIS, rather than undergoing a complete reprocurement, as other states have done, for example, the state of Florida is spending $300 million to reprocure their MMIS. We've done modular evolution, so we have moved into, for example, a relational database for our claims subsystem in Health Match, or in MMIS. Health Match will be using some of the same technologies as what we're moving forward with the MMIS. We are working on interfaces with MAXIS that we can do more easily with web than we could do with mainframe. As to the dollar amount, our total development contract with our vendor, Albion Inc., after our last contract amendment, sits at a grand total of $22 million and some odd dollars. This is a performance-based contract. It's not time and materials. And to date, we've expended less than $5 million in payments to Albion. So we've only spent 21% of the budget. We have not gone over budget. The contract is being managed quite tightly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's, you're talking just about Health Match for that amount of money, and that's, you're just talking about Albion as one of the contractors, but there are many contractors that are helping with the Health Match system, and there's a company that had it before Albion as well. That was, well, at least that's what we're getting in the information that we get here. So, and on top of that, I understand that, you know, last year in our legislation, we had a number of contractors that were still getting paid for doing MAXIS and MMIS. Is there going to be, when all this is over with, one system that does it also? We're not continuing to pay millions and millions of taxpayers' dollars for three different systems, none of which are working like they're supposed to work, and which have been, now, I think it was 1990 or something when these systems were started being developed. Now we're being told by you, Ms. Davis-Johnson, that the systems are, the MMIS and MAXIS are not up to date, where we've been paying millions of dollars each year to update them. So I'm still very concerned about the amount of money that's being spent on systems that don't seem to be working. And
Ms. Davis-Johnson, response?
Mr. Chair, Representative, to go back to the comment about a previous vendor for Albion, Albion has changed their name. They used to be SSI North America. They started with the original Orion Consulting Group that was from the Twin Cities, series of merger acquisitions. We still have the same vendor for other firms, staff that we're dealing with. Perhaps I misspoke when I talked about MAXIS and MMIS using older technology. Both systems have continued to do updates and to bring in modules where they can use the new technology. So there's, I seen dramatic improvements in efficiencies in how we are using these systems. As to whether or not we will have one system for all eligibility, the framework we are building with HealthMatch has the ability to do multiple programs. The state of Wyoming is using the same framework for all of their programs, health care, food support, child care, Medicaid. They are a little farther ahead in development than we are. So technically it's possible. I have not been given direction from anybody at the department, nor I believe has anyone else, to integrate all of these. But technically we have the ability to do so if that's the direction that we get.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further testimony, thank you very much for your testimony. Most of the questions. Representative Tao, I want to put you to work. I know that you've been spending your time reviewing the minutes of Wednesday, November 16th, and Thursday, January 26th. Would you be willing to move adoption of those minutes?
Okay, sure.
Mr. Tao moves approval of the November 16th and November 26th minutes. Are there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have one more testifier, Karen Gibson, Elderly and Disabled Eligibility Policy, Department of Human Services. Good morning. Welcome to the committee, and I see you have able assistance here as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Karen Gibson with the Healthcare Eligibility and Access Division at the Department of Human Services.
I'm Steve Nelson. I'm with the Healthcare Administration of the Department of Human Services.
I'm going to provide an update on our implementation of the 05 program integrity provisions that passed last session. There were quite a number of them, and as I guess has previously been discussed, some of them are looking for HealthMatch to kind of improve how we do things, but most of them were required to be implemented to the extent possible before HealthMatch comes up. In medical assistance, there were actually four eligibility provisions that passed. One required an update of the assets and income for pregnant women following the end of the postpartum period. So these individuals would need to provide an update to the county worker, in this case, because it's medical assistance, and would need to submit any required verification of income or assets in order for eligibility to continue. A second change related to what we refer to as auto newborns, infants who are put on our program because their mother gave birth at the time they were born and the mother remains in the state and otherwise eligible. For those children as well as other infants under age one, there is now a requirement that we collect information, or the counties collect information on their private sector health care coverage and submit that for a determination of cost effectiveness in order to offset MA costs. Another provision under MA required the modification of our application form and other forms to require more detailed information relating to verification of assets and income, and required the verification and assets of assets and income for all applicants and all recipients upon renewal. The fourth change was related to the reporting of new income or increased earned income by recipients. They are required to report those changes within 10 days and to verify that new or increased earned income, if it affects eligibility, within 10 days of notification by the agency. Recipients who fail to verify that income would lose eligibility with a 10-day notice. The steps that we took to implement the provision in terms of a manual approach pre-HealthMatch were to provide a bulletin to counties. Our main method of issuing instructions to them is to issue a bulletin to them instructing them on the process and steps they need to take. We have updated our manual materials around this. We have also presented at the monthly supervisors meeting to inform them of other of changes. Enrollees and recipients were notified in a mass notice of all legislative changes that were made by the 2005 legislature, so they got it, actually I believe in August they got their notification of that, and we continue to respond if there are questions from counties or enrollees as they arise. I'm going to move on to the Minnesota Care provisions that were passed. Those were just the medical assistance ones. There were a number of program integrity provisions relating to Minnesota Care that have been implemented. One requires the verification of all earned and unearned income for applicants and recipients at renewal. Failure to provide a required verification would result in denial of the application or termination with 10-day notice for an enroller from the program. Prior to that change, unearned income was not routinely verified. It was only verified if inconsistent information was received that the county had or the applicant or enroller provided inconsistent information. A second change related to Minnesota Care that has been implemented is around premiums for Minnesota Care. Premiums for Minnesota Care generally are established at application and renewal, and previously in the past, under limited situations, were premiums modified in between renewals. But the law changed from last session required all reported income changes, both an increase in income and a decrease in income, to immediately be acted upon relative to a Minnesota Care premium. With both of these Minnesota Care changes, again, we took the same steps in terms of implementing, issuing the bulletin to county, providing updated manual material, meeting with them at their monthly supervisors meeting, updating or training material for county workers, and responding to any questions that they might have. Some items have not yet been implemented and are pending, one of which is around the verification of employer subsidized insurance for enrollees, applicants and enrollees and their dependents. At the end of the special session, there was a modification of the language which required telephone contact with the enrollee's employer to verify. Prior to that, I believe it was a form-based approach. With that late modification, no additional admin was provided, and the phone contact process is a labor-intensive process, so the department has not yet implemented that provision, but we are working to develop a pilot of that process so we can determine what techniques would work best before we go full force and try to implement that one. Two other provisions passed last session which have not been implemented. They require federal approval and federal approval is pending. One provision relates to the prohibition of Minnesota Care eligibility for individuals under age 21 who are enrolled in a program of post-secondary study at a post-secondary education institution and who have access through that institution to health insurance coverage. The second provision that is pending with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is a premium increase where after the premium is calculated, an additional 8% is added to the premium for all adults regardless of their income level and for children with income above 150% of federal poverty guidelines. So those two provisions are pending. We have received questions from CMS and responded to questions on both these provisions, but as of yet, the approval has not been received and we're waiting to hear from them. That's all that I've said. Do you have any questions?
Mr. Nelson, do you have any testimony or are you here in case questions?
I'm just here to learn and to help out.
Okay, thank you.
Let me start with at least one. On the federal approval, particularly on the prohibition for under 21, if in post-secondary, I thought that sort of fit under the general guidelines of Minnesota Care, if you have insurance offered that we didn't want to erode the private marketplace, how is it that we have to get a federal waiver for that provision?
Minnesota Care operates under an 1116 waiver, so if we are going to make a change like this, we have to amend our waiver and in order to get the FFP for that.
So I'm well aware that we do, although not all of Minnesota Care are dependent minors under 21. I know that we have MA essentially eligible to waiver for younger children, but I didn't realize it went up to that age. If you're 20 years old, how does that fit into the waiver? I didn't think they were part of the waiver.
Mr. Chair, yes, the children, you know, under 21 are, I believe, part of the waiver. Of course, our Adults Without Children group is our state-funded group on Minnesota Care, where we don't need the federal approval, but for this we do need the federal.
Mr. Van implies that we're getting a federal match for Minnesota Care for, I'm not sure, but my son might object if I use the word child at 20 years old, but is that what that implies, is that we're getting federal match for that age?
Yes, I believe that's correct. We are getting federal match.
Okay. That's a memo?
Thank you.
Ms. Gibson, I would like to get, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Gibson, I would like to get a copy. I think we had a meeting a couple, 3 weeks ago, and I still haven't seen it. Maybe you've supplied it to staff, but I would like to see the letters and the responses yet with respect to the issue that Chairman Bradley just went through. The question I have, your testimony with respect to one of the reasons that you have not done this, you haven't implemented this employer verification, and this is what you told me when we met a few weeks ago, is because of this 11th hour addition that required a telephone interview. But in fact, ma'am, that really is a misstatement because I've read the language, and it doesn't say anything about required. What it says, and I think it's in Section 65, it says the commissioner shall also require applicants and enrollees to submit the names of their employers and a contact name with a telephone number for each employer for purposes of verifying whether the applicant or enrollee and any dependents are eligible for employer-subsidized coverage. I have some serious concerns as to why this hasn't been implemented, because nothing in that language suggests that you are required to make a phone call. And actually, this integrity reform was intended to try and help address the concern raised by the audit that showed that a third of the applications were inadequate, and especially when it came to verification of earned income, because that's all we were looking at apparently back at that time. Could you please tell me who's interpreted within the department? I'm going to ask probably an insensitive question, and it won't be the first time. But when we were sitting down in my office, it was you alerted me, and the lady that was with you alerted me to the fact Senator Berglund had actually offered this 11th hour language about a telephone interview. After we met, I had an opportunity to actually read the language. First, maybe I'm looking at the wrong language because I don't see where a telephone interview is required. The language just says a contact information. And second, I have serious concerns that if Senator Berglund was putting this in, has someone in your department been talking to Senator Berglund in an effort to interpret what this means? And is that why it hasn't been implemented? Ms. Gibson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, our understanding of this was that the modifications were made in an effort to, I think, put more of the onus on the agency to do the verification as opposed to the applicant or enrollee, and that we were interpreting the language to require that. By collecting that information, the purpose of collecting that information was indeed to verify it.
Okay.
through a telephone contact with the individual's employer.
Well, excuse me, Representative, if I can comment, I was there. The notion of the verification was sort of fundamental to the reforms we're talking about. I mean, that's what this was all about. The telephone number was just a way to identify a little more readily how you reach the employer. Whether you do it, I mean, there's nothing in there that says you couldn't do it by another technique. But it was part of the fiscal mess that we got. It's part of the reason that we had to invest additional money. And from the very beginning, I think this reform said that we want to be sure that that there is a verification through the employer that there is or is not insurance. I mean, you know, you understand Minnesota law, of course. You're not supposed to be on Minnesota care if you have alternative insurance through your employer. So that was the whole purpose. The telephone call is almost incidental. I mean, it's nothing more than just an alternative way to reach the employer. And that was supposed to be actually a convenience. If you didn't have that statement in there, I think you could argue that it takes a little more chasing to find the employer. Ms. Gibson, does that make sense to you? I'm struggling myself as to why that becomes a barrier, that specific language about telephone.
Representative Bradley, yes, your comment does make sense to me. But again, I believe our understanding and interpretation of that was that we would be requiring putting the agency, our Minnesota CAP staff, to call all of the employers to verify that.
Well, Mr. Gibson, I think it is fair to say that this whole section there was there so that the department would use that as an authorization to verify employer insurance. In fact, as we had discussion, we were told that there's whole groups of people working for larger companies where we don't need to call because you know that company XYZ offers insurance to every employee, so you don't even need to call. You know that one. And then there's others where you don't know, and this is just a convenience. But certainly it was expected, and that's why we have fiscal notes here, that the department was to verify that eligibility. And nothing more. I'm sorry, but you know, I need to dominate this, but I was a part of those discussions, and it never occurred to us anything less than yes, we were, based on the audit of 2003, saying that we ought to do a better job of auditing that form of eligibility. And I interrupted you when I was.
That's quite all right, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Gibson. It still takes me back to the question, because you say our understanding of this addition, the person that apparently offered it was Senator Berglund. And my question was, is Senator Berglund the one who is interpreting this for your department? Or, if that's not the case, who interpreted language that I just read to you that nowhere says that a telephone interview is required? And I'll just take you back before you ask the question. When we met my office, I said to you that this is the difference in our approach, that these reforms were intended to put the onus on the applicant to establish his or her eligibility for the program, so it should not have added cost or effort on the part of the department. Mm-hmm. And again, as a follow-up, after the meeting, having an opportunity to look at the fiscal note, and I think Ms. Scarpace was up here earlier and was commenting on the governor's proposals that were passed when she was talking about, mm-hmm. I had asked her to explain to me PERM. Those administrative allowances were for the governor's proposals, but if you look at the administrative allowances, they are significant for these reforms, these integrity reforms. So I'll add a question. First, where are you getting your interpretation? Is it coming from Senator Berglund, who offered the language? And second, what's happening to all the money that the department got to put these things into place? Because it's substantial.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, no, the department is not, that was our independent interpretation, and certainly we can go back and revisit that given the clarification, I guess, that has been provided to us, but not, that was not coming from Senator Bergen. In terms of the additional investments that were made here, Minnesota Care Operations, at least the state portion of that, is in the process of hiring. They have a significant amount of turnover in Minnesota Care Operations, and they are pretty much constantly in a situation of hiring. In calendar year 05, they hired 61 positions, but during that same period, they lost 49. So they are in the process, too, of posting and hiring for some additional positions to complete this. In a five-month period in 2005, they conducted 193 job interviews because they've had a pretty significant amount of turnover. So they are trying to fully staff and trying to maintain that staffing, but they are having some difficulty in doing that.
One more.
What's the number?
Mr. Chairman, and it's a two-part question. Again, first, I appreciate that it doesn't come, it was internal. I understand from your answer that it was an internal interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Ma'am, if the department has notes or opinions that specifically address this, because this is an issue that the department was allotted substantial dollars to implement, and I don't know why. When, if I read this right, it says dollars and thousands up here, and it says administration $337,000. It says administration again, $3.2 million. It says administration again, $1.07 million. And then something called multi-section costs. I never understand all these different terms, but you've got substantial money that was allotted for this and these other reforms. And you're talking about the turnover. I can understand that the business of government is probably very difficult. But does the money just sit in an account somewhere? And when are we going to determine how to implement this? What was the money going to be for? What happens to it?
Mr. Nelson?
Chairman Bradley, Representative Emmer, the funds that aren't spent do sit in the Minnesota Care Operations accounts. We are aggressively seeking employees to fill the positions that would be funded by that money, and are looking at other investments such as in technology to deal with serving all the Minnesota Care clients, Minnesota Care applicants that are out there, so we can move down a backlog that has developed over the past few months.
Excuse me, Mr. Mayor, if I may again interest you just a little bit. I think the picture is a little different than what you might be thinking, Representative Emmer, which makes it perhaps all the worse. Because what you were talking about was sort of the additional investment. I can assure you in my conversations with Senator Bergen, we would never have these measures if it were a net extra investment. The reality is that it was predicted to save in the 06-07 biennium over $6.3 million. What I'm wondering about, Mr. Nelson, is sort of, I mean, because we were depending on that. We were counting on those fiscal notes, those savings. If we're not making the investments on the cost side, which were, they were truly investments to get us a return, then where are we? Are we currently spending spending down precious Minnesota Care Healthcare Access Fund dollars because we're not accumulating the savings that we're anticipating? Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that to the extent that the fiscal notes were representative of the savings that would be developed with this extra staff, I would say that would be the case.
And I can only say, Mr. Nelson, with all respect, and I realize, and I'm chairman of the Personnel Committee myself, I understand turnovers and those things, and I spend a lot of hours, as a matter of fact, all morning this morning interviewing people. As a chair, that's disappointing. I'd have to say that's very disappointing. Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this might be replicative, but initially when we did the auditing and we listened to the auditor, I realized that they talked about that some of the Minnesota Care people had insurance or supposedly didn't. And my recollection in that whole conversation was that there were a number of people who said that they didn't have insurance, and the employer said they did. But when I remember listening to the auditor was, in most of those cases, actually, the employer referred to, yes, we had insurance for the company, but not necessarily everybody in the company. And I've had calls from my constituents on that very same thing, where they've been denied, and you go to the company and they say, oh, yeah, they don't have insurance. That department doesn't have insurance. So I think we have to be really careful with some of these phone calls, because somebody in the office says, yeah, we have insurance, and the auditor warned us of that very clearly, that a lot of those were people who really didn't have insurance, but the person that they called said, thinking that somebody had insurance, so they said yes. And time after time, I'm fixing up stuff like that, that your department is getting the information that, yes, we have insurance, but they don't ask about specifically this department in that company who doesn't have insurance. And that's very common nowadays. Even in schools, I have 3 schools that have no health insurance, but the superintendents do. And if the superintendent's secretary answered, they'd say, yeah, there's insurance, but not everybody has it. And I think that has to be clear if and when you do that calling for the specific job that they are doing at that company.
That's true. Well, Senator Fender, perhaps you found the one silver lining here is the fact that it hasn't been implemented, that this kind of advice is well taken. I'm stretching a little bit. Mr. Bummer?
One more thing, and I'm sorry, but I get really frustrated because I was told that things move slow down here, and this is, I thought we had made some real progress, at least based on the auditor's report. One of the things that you testified to, Ms. Gibson, was these notices that went out in August. I'm just wondering, your notices, the bulletins that went out to the counties, and the notices that went out to the people that are in the program. One of the other things that was required was that the application for all health care programs be modified. Has that been done? And how did you, if it has it been communicated out to the counties, and is that has that been implemented?
Ms. Gibson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, we have application forms and several different renewal forms. The application form is in the process of being revised. County workers have been instructed that they need to go ahead and implement the verification procedures even though the form isn't revised yet. The renewal form, one of the renewal forms has been revised. The other renewal form will be revised and available mid-April.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Gibson, what's taking so long? I mean, it's just about verifying income. And I would think there are plenty of examples. Just maybe tax forms could give us some pretty good examples. What's taking so long?
Ms. Gibson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the process, I think, there's a number of things around this, but the department has tried to consolidate as many changes that we need to our forms as possible, because it is a time-consuming process and it's expensive to constantly make changes. So many of these provisions we're trying to integrate into any other changes that we need on our application forms, where we need more detailed information or more accurate provisions. I can't respond probably beyond that on that issue.
What's Senator Crumbo?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've gone to several counties, just not identifying myself, asking for the new Minnesota Care guidelines. And many of them still say that the cap is on. And so then I've had my constituents call the outsourcing line, and they tell them the same thing, that your $5,000 cap starts over, and they talk about the same thing with the dental piece. And I think that's a pretty serious thing, because this happened this month again, and I asked, well, who did you call for the helpline? And they said, well, it was somebody with an accent. And it was and they said that they didn't qualify. And over again, that's what's happening. And as I went from county to county, they were giving wrong information. One county had the right information, and so I don't know where that's slipping through.
Mr. Chairman, any response to that? These were things that were passed in the last legislative session as well, so...
Mr. Chair, Representative Trimble, we can get, again, additional information out to counties on that if there is some confusion about that. I think you're referencing the Minnesota Care Limited Benefit.
Right.
We can get some.
You can feed that back and make sure that gets distributed to the committee. Representative Bigham?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another comment along the lines of Representative Otremba's is there is not information out there that the dental cap has been lifted either. And I have constituents who called me just in the last couple of weeks and said they went to the dentist and the dentist had to tell them that he couldn't treat them because there was a limit and he'd already reached the $500 limit. In addition to that, I've looked on the website at some of the forms, Minnesota Care and so forth, for different constituents, and I don't see the updates that we made last session either. I wouldn't think this was unusual for like 3 months, but it's been a lot longer than that. So people, even about the premiums, people aren't getting the correct information yet. So I don't think it's just the counties that don't know. I think the providers don't know, and I think the patients, the clients, are being told the wrong information about their benefit set, too. So there just seems to be a lot more misunderstanding out there at this point in the game than there ought to be. And again, some of these folks have called the department, and the department hasn't had the correct or given them the correct information either. Thank you.
Ms. Gibson, I'm not exactly sure how you sort of review that or across all counties, but it might be helpful to this committee to sort of get an updated reading, and you've heard, and if it's anecdotal, if it's wrong, whatever, then please inform us and demonstrate somehow for us, because these are the kinds of calls that we get from constituents, and we assume when we pass laws and have dates that things are happening within those timelines. What's in the paper?
Thank you, Ms. Gibson. Happy Valentine's Day. Maybe you could have brought the cookies. Might have been a good idea next time to bring them. Just a question. Is this a shortfall that we're going to experience the F&B in the February forecast, then? We'll see $6 million.
Mr. Nelson? I think what Resident Abel referring to, and I don't know if it would be the 4 or 6, but as I just indicated, that's for the entire biennium. But clicking off to this point, if we've not gathered in the savings that would have been predicted at this point, there must be some sort of shortfall. Yeah. So it's still be relevant to say, are we going to see something in the forecast, or did we already accommodate in the last forecast a change in assumptions here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I'm not sure how Mr. Hoffman is carrying this in the February forecast, whether he had already accounted for some of it already.
Could you, that's really important to me to know. I mean, sometimes the Minnesota Care Healthcare Access Fund doesn't get the same level of scrutiny as the general fund. We often hear a lot about the general fund, but we don't see the same detail, Representative Abler, and that might be an explanation. I really would like to know what the consequences are from a fiscal point of view to our healthcare access fund budget for the discussion that we've had this morning. Further questions? With November, we just about used up your quota, wasn't it? So go ahead. Yes, so let me get thin skin and Mrs. Huff.
I feel like wilting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Gibson, you didn't answer my question earlier. My question had to do with the intent of the reform on the revision to the application. It was intended to be applied to all health care programs, and maybe I didn't ask it the right way. My understanding is it hasn't been completed, number one, and number two, that your department may only be doing it on one of the programs. It's supposed to be on all programs. Is that the department's understanding?
Ms. Gibson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Enner, the application forms and renewal forms we use are across all programs. So when it's in, it will be applied, it will be in the single application form. We do have a generic application form that we use. We don't have a separate form for medical assistance in the Civil Care GMC. And then your second question, I think, is with regard to the verification and of the assets and income for all recipients. The verification of assets provision, that is the piece that we are applying in Minnesota, or excuse me, medical assistance, not to DAMC or Minnesota Care.
Mr. Chairman, there's a number. Ms. Gibson, I believe it was supposed to be applied to all health care programs. And is that another interpretation that's been made by the department?
Ms. Gibson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, yes, change in language was put in the medical assistance statute, so we only applied it to the medical assistance program.
Ms. Gibson, I think the language where we said Minnesota Healthcare Programs, if it was improperly placed, I'd like to revisit that because it was certainly the intent, as much as I was involved, for to apply to all Minnesota health programs. We may need to follow up, but it certainly was at my understanding.
If that was the intent. And I believe there's, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Gibson, I believe there's ample reference throughout the legislation that was passed last year, if the department will take a look at it and revisit it. And if the position is that it's coded in the wrong place, then perhaps it needs to be expanded, because it was the intent that it be all health care programs.
Well, we're close enough to a new session. If we have to do some update to that, Representative, I look forward to you having the ability to do that. I don't know if you heard my invitation, but if it does need some clarification for this legislative session, I'm looking forward to you having a bill.
I've met my quota.
Well, I hope you took it as good fun and jest. I really appreciate, Representative Emmer, your good questions today. These are really important points to be made. But I know you're sensitive, so. Seeing no further questions, Representative Abel, did you have?
I'll just have an advertisement and then something to pass.
Sure, why don't you? Well, before we do that, though, let's make sure that we don't have any further questions. I know sometimes when we're trying to do our legislative business, it creates kind of what could be a tension, and for that, I think we're professionals. We have our business to do, and I think it's the right thing to have good questions like this asked. So in that regard, I certainly don't intend that there be anything personal today, and I would offer this as an author who is there through the nights and through things. There are questions of interpretations, and I think there's also some implication, Mr. Nelson and Ms. Gibson, about some follow-up here that I would certainly offer my help. What's done is done, but I would certainly hope that we take some advice from the discussion this afternoon to help expedite, to perhaps clarify some interpretations, and to the extent that I can offer help to that, I would certainly offer to do that. I do appreciate very much your coming, your honest testimony today, and sharing with the committee the information that you did. We have some challenges ahead, but I'm prepared to help with as most as I possibly can with that. So thank you so much for your testimony this afternoon. And now, Representative Abler, if you pay us right, you're entitled to this advertisement. Is it happening?
Go first.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is supposed to happen today, I would guess. But I didn't make cookies either, Mr. Chair. But on the in terms of the Division for Healthcare Cost Containment, schedule-wise, it's a little tight to get anything fit in of substance and consequence before a session. But in talking to staff, it made sense to try to get together the Tuesday before we come back officially. For a hearing on the 28th of February from 10 till 1, and then after session, I think we'll do it at about 2:30 or after Ways and Means gets done, after session on Wednesday, on those days, and hopefully 2 days the week after, and if we're lucky, we can get our division's work done by then, knowing that there's a short deadline. So that's optimistic, but I think realistic. And if many of you serve on both, if you have ideas you want to bring forward, please, this is a good time. Also, in the other packets, you've got some work about MEEP and PEEP reform. A lot of acronyms will be happening probably this year, as well as a reinsurance idea. There is a lot of high points to that, which I'd like people to react to. It's been passed off to the audience and to the members. It's been sent to by email to the members. And there'll be a summary coming. It's been kind of quick to get that put out, but that'll be pre-filed for a good debate. Any comments are welcome and sought. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Representative Huntley?
Mr. Chair, this is just for your information. You probably are aware of it, but the federal bill that passed 2 weeks ago apparently has some dramatic cuts in case management. In my case, St. Louis County, it's about $9 million. And it's certainly bigger in Hennepin County. And I'm wondering if sometime either early in the session or even before the session, if we could have the Department of Human Services and maybe the counties come in and tell us what they think this is going to do. This may be an area that we have to do something this year in the budget.
Definitely, yes, I am. Well, as much as a person can be on top of it, since it is a moving target, and even yet, there are advocacies for amendments going on. Even as recent as this morning, I was asked to take some action. I just wrote a letter. I mean, so there is still some potential that this might change. I suppose whatever it is, if it changes entirely, that's one thing. But if it doesn't, and those consequences are there, I thought you were maybe volunteering that this would be one time that the Youth and the Iron Range would offer to solve a statewide problem for us. Well, I shouldn't be so tongue-in-cheek on this, because it is a serious issue, I realize. And I think certainly, and I don't know if all the right people are here, but to the extent that there are, the counties and the department ought to stand ready to help provide this committee advice, because I think you're right. I don't know exactly what the action ought to be, and I'm not so sure. I certainly have not been prepared to promise people that we have the means to completely fill the gaps either, but it is an important issue that we need to pay attention when your point is well taken, Representative Huntley. So, no further discussion. This meeting is adjourned.